regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Well, welcome, everyone, to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion are those of our experts on today's call. As today, February 22nd, 2020, and we're joined by the moderator for our discussion today, Ms. Svetlana Ganz. She's Vice President and Associate General Counsel at NCTA. She's also a member of a few different practice groups at the Federalist Society. And so the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group and the Regulatory Transparency Project are both co-hosting this discussion today. So with that, Svetlana, I'll hand the floor off to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Nick. And thank you for the Federalist Society for hosting my fireside chat with Bilal Saeed. We're very thrilled, Bilal, that you are joined us this afternoon. So just a brief introduction on Bilal. Bilal previously served as the Director of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission, where he led the agency's work on the 21st century hearings, the examination of non-compete clauses in employment contracts, and the Big Tech 6B study pertaining to past acquisitions. Bilal recently left the agency and is currently a senior adjunct fellow at Tech Freedom. Previously, Bilal was an attorney in private practice and served as an attorney advisor to FTC Chairman Tim Urist from 2001 to 2004. Bilal, thank you so much for being with us here today.
All right. I'm excited. Great.
All right. So let's jump right in. And just for the audience, we will be taking questions from the audience in two ways. First, you could utilize the Zoom chat feature. I will be monitoring it. Second, you could also raise your hand in the Q&A feature, and I will try to get your questions that way. So with that, let's kick it off with the first question that I had, Bilal, regarding the FTC 21st century hearings. The FTC held the hearings throughout the fall and spring of 2018 and 2019. The goal was to determine whether the broad-based changes in the economy, evolving business practices, new technologies, or international developments might require adjustments to the way that the FTC competition, consumer protection, law policies, and priority might change. Can you give our audience a brief synopsis on the goals for the hearings?
So I think there are a few goals for the hearing. I think most important was the chairman's interest in both sort of identifying and shaping and maybe potentially revising sort of a consensus about, you know, the scope of the proper scope of antitrust in, you know, within sort of the economy and as a matter of sort of government policy, right? So, you know, coming into the commission, there was a lot of, or, you know, some ferment about what the agencies should be doing, whether they had done enough in the past, both on antitrust and also with respect to privacy and maybe some other consumer protection, what are considered consumer protection topics. And there was also some question also about, you know, sort of beyond the agencies and whether the law as enforced, you know, sort of in the courts through, you know, through private litigation was sort of sufficiently robust and attentive to, you know, at least perceived competitive problems in the economy. So I think Joe wanted to get a full spectrum of views, both through the hearings, the physical hearings, let's say, and the written comments on where people thought, you know, antitrust was sort of properly enforced or properly moving forward, and properly developing, and where it wasn't. So I think that was the main goal. I think there were a few things that we thought were important to get done. You know, they'd either been not done in many years, and an example of that, you know, is the vertical merger guidelines, or try to provide guidance on, you know, topics that were, you know, topical, like acquisitions of potential or nascent competitors, and evaluating the conduct of so-called or allegedly dominant platform companies, and, you know, a few other areas like common ownership. There have been some empirical research. So I think there was a hope and a desire to sort of try to address some open issues, open requests for guidance, and those were both, you know, sort of older things like vertical mergers and newer issues that were coming up. So I think those were the two primary goals.
Thanks for that background. Can you discuss some of the accomplishments from the hearings?
So I think the biggest accomplishment, and maybe the only public accomplishment, you know, was the vertical merger guidelines that, you know, DOJ and the FTC did together, and the vertical merger commentary that sort of complements the guidelines that was done by the FTC, right? It had been, as you know, and as probably many of the folks listening know, the 1982/1984 merger guidelines were the last U.S. government publication of an analytical framework for vertical mergers. So they were, you know, by the time the hearings got started and ran their course, it had been roughly 35 years before the agencies had given or provided a framework for analyzing vertical mergers that, you know, reflected the reality of vertical merger analysis. So that was the biggest accomplishment. And although we went into that, you know, believing that it was worth doing, I think we wanted to make sure that there was actually a desire for such, you know, guidelines or guidance. And so it wasn't, you know, preordained that we would do it. But I think the feedback we got made it possible to do, develop, you know, some support for it. Of course, it was an area where there was relative uniformity of views between DOJ and the FTC, which also made it possible to do. And of course, within the FTC, you know, the staff, the bureaus, BC and BE, of course, had a lot of experience with vertical mergers. And so, you know, there was not a lot of internal concern about doing them. But I think, so that I think was the biggest accomplishment. And I think, in fact, I think it is, in fact, an impressive accomplishment, given that there had been calls to update the, you know, the framework from the 82 and 84 guidelines since the mid-90s. And, you know, that's a long time. When I was there with Mieris in 2001, there was some thought about trying to do it, but, you know, we didn't. You know, the AMC called for more, you know, the Anarchist Modernization Commission called for guidance in 2007 or 2008 on vertical mergers. And the ABA, you know, has in its past reports to the transition teams has called for guidance. And, you know, we got it done. And Joe and Macon deserve a lot of credit, you know, for getting something done that had been, you know, sort of under consideration in some way, and you know, for 20 to 25 years. It was also, you know, the U.S. was about the only competition agency of note whose merger guidelines did not reflect an analytical framework for vertical mergers, you know, or at least the current one. And so I think it was a major accomplishment and a sort of a necessary one, right? Because that, I wouldn't call it low-hanging fruit, but of all the things we wanted to do, that was the one where, you know, I think there was a view of, you know, there was enough out there that we could do it.
Great. So one thing you mentioned earlier on is that you looked at platform-based businesses and digital markets as part of your hearings. In particular, the October 2018 hearings focused in part on the identification analysis of potentially collusive, exclusionary, and predatory conduct by digital and technology-based platform businesses. Following these hearings, the FTC was contemplating issuing a report on how the antitrust laws apply to digital markets with some case studies. However, no such report was issued. Can you describe generally what the FTC was seeking to achieve and the challenges presented with issuing a report?
Well, let me clarify that slightly, right? You know, as we went through the process and thought about what the output would be from the hearings, we thought about doing a report, either narrow reports on specific topics or a big report, you know, across many or all the topics. And, you know, given the dynamics of the commission, it did not seem like we would get a good report out that had unanimous consent, you know, or unanimous approval. So we decided, rather than write a report that, you know, either was a little bit on the one hand and on the other hand, or, you know, ended up with a 3-2 vote, split vote, that we would focus on projects that try to identify for the public how the agency, or maybe agencies, you know, were evaluating either conduct or mergers. And that, you know, that was what we did with the vertical merger guidelines and commentary. And it's what we tried to do with the application of the antitrust laws to the, you know, to the so-called tech platforms. What OPP wanted to do, and, you know, which I think we had approval to do, was to craft a guidelines document that looked not like the horizontal merger guidelines, but looked like the competitor collaboration guidelines, but with respect to Section 2, mostly with respect to the application of Section 2 to, you know, single firm conduct, taking account of the potential uniqueness of platform companies, two-sided markets, strong network effects, things like that. So what our goal was there was, like the CCGs from 2000, was to try to develop a framework that was sort of forward-looking on how we thought the law the law should apply, both sort of outside the commission and sort of by the agencies, right? So there's a lot of Section 2 law, and not all of it is good law, and there's some inconsistencies in it. And there's also some things from, you know, Section 1 law that might be useful to apply to the analysis of single firm conduct. And so what we tried to do specifically was adopt and put forward a framework for, again, mostly the application of Section 2 that adopted, but also modified and tried to advance, you know, the balancing approach in US v. Microsoft. Now, You know, and that would be sort of an application of the rule of reason. But a full application of the rule of reason. You know, I started most of my time doing antitrust has been with Tim Uris. Tim had always been a very strong proponent of the use of a structured rule of reason approach to Section 1 conduct. So, you know, our effort was to try to take the best of Section 2 law and some of Section 1 law and create a framework that the FTC could use to evaluate, dominant, the so-called dominant firm conduct here limited to platforms. Had we, you know, had DOJ on the effort, it might have been slightly different. But what I thought we could do, well, I think we were going to do two things. If you'll recall, the Section 2 report that DOJ issued in 2008 was quite dismissive of the ability of courts and the agencies to do sort of a balancing effects-based test for Section 2. They were concerned that would lead to potentially over-enforcement through type 1 error. And as you recall, that report proposed sort of a disproportionality test for application of Section 2. Well, we thought that their concern about the balancing test, while valid, should actually be engaged on. And I think the folks in OPP who worked on this and myself thought that we had a real opportunity to try to develop Section 2 law under the guise of applying Section 5, you know, at the commission in a way that would, over time, potentially move towards a more vigorous and rigorous use of, you know, the balancing effects-based approach of Microsoft. Now, you know, any reader of Microsoft knows that while they set out a framework for balancing, there was not a lot of balancing done because, at least as the opinion wrote it, there was only, I think, one instance where the conduct, where Microsoft came forward with some efficiency or justification for the conduct that the court recognized. And so there was very little balancing done. In the instance where Microsoft did come forward with a justification, the court found from, you know, Microsoft on that issue. So we wanted to add some real structure and framework to the balancing approach structured balancing approach. And you know, since it turned out DOJ was not going to participate with us, create something that the FTC could identify through its administrative system that would, you know, develop it through application of Section 5, right? So that would have some protection from the existing case law in Section 2, although we weren't necessarily going to depart substantially from some of the existing case law, except for sort of a requirement of true balancing. Avoid some of the hindrance of developing case law in private litigation, right? So we thought that, you know, it was a very sensible approach, taking advantage of the FTC's unique role with its administrative law system. We couldn't get it done for a few reasons. I think the key reason was, of course, at the same time we were thinking about, you know, drafting and providing a framework on basically application of Section 2 to platform companies. Both DOJ and the FTC had significant investigations and potential, and then of course actual enforcement actions against platform companies. So there was a concern that anything we wrote in a guidelines format would affect the litigation. And so there was some concern about that. I think there was disagreement, on the substance of some of the, where, in a sense, where OPP sort of came out. We'd like to go this way with the law. Other people might want to go a different way. Those, I think, could have been resolved because our goal was not to set up an OPP version of the world with respect to Section 2, but to identify both what the FTC, had been doing and thought it should be doing going forward. And if that was something different than what I would have drafted or so what, right? It was intended to be very transparent of what we were doing and also set some, direction, help set some direction for what we did. But it was too fraught with potential conflict or harm in the enforcement actions. And I think we could have got over that too, but I understand that concern. I think there it's a bit of a shame because a number of other jurisdictions have put out guidance on application of their laws to conduct by dominant or allegedly dominant platform companies. I think what we did was better. And I think what we did, with the improvements that would have happened, I think naturally engaging with the staff and maybe even DOJ would have been better. We hired a number of academics to review the document. We got very good feedback from them, both in terms of changes that might be needed or that they might suggest or issues we might want to make sure we address. But in general, I think the feedback was positive, that it was it would have been a significant step forward in, a framework for using Section 2. I want to say one more thing just so I don't forget it. This was initially a project initiated by OPP. Of course, we sought comment from the bureaus, but it also built on a lot of good work that the FTC team that was part of the Section 2 hearings back in, early, mid-2000s did. So Bill Cohen, Tom Klotz, Bill Atkinson were still at the FTC, did a lot of good work, great work. That didn't make it into the Section 2 report. We used quite a bit of that as a foundation for some of what we were doing. Of course, I mentioned the three people on that who were still at the commission. There were a number of other people who worked on that, whose work we drew on. So, it was an effort to build on work the agency had done. But also to be reflective of, changes over the last 10, 15 years. So I think it's a real shame it didn't get out. I don't see it getting out now with the litigation actually in process. But it's to me a major, it's a significant gap that the FTC and DOJ do not have guidance on application of U.S. antitrust laws dissimilar from conduct, the way they do for mergers and Section 1, mostly Section 1 to joint ventures. So anyway, I'll stop there. That's a lot.
Great. Well, thank you for that. One other area that you mentioned the FTC was interested in was the topic of nascent competition issues broadly. You did focus a little bit on that on the hearings, and then subsequent to the hearings in February of 2020, the FTC issued a 6B market study to Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, seeking 10 years of transaction data to, quote, deepen its understanding of large technology firms' acquisition activity including whether large tech platforms have been making potentially anti-competitive acquisitions of nascent or potential competitors that fall below the HSR reporting thresholds, end quote. Can you elaborate briefly on the FTC's goals with respect to the nascent competition area of inquiry?
Sure. So I'll take that in two parts. First, there's this view out there in the broader antitrust community that the agencies don't have either a framework for evaluating, the acquisition or combination involving potential competitors or future competitors, nascent competitors, or what I call emerging competitors, right? There's a misperception that the horizontal merger guidelines don't talk about potential competition or emerging competition. That's in part because the 82-84 guidelines had a section on potential competition and the horizontal merger guidelines don't. Now, of course, anyone who's read the horizontal merger guidelines knows that they talk about potential competition. Anyone who understands them knows they talk about the evaluation of emerging competitors, including but not limited to, the evaluation of the innovation effects of mergers. Same with the vertical merger guidelines. They have a reference to evaluating conduct that may exclude or eliminate competition from future or potential competitors. So part of what we wanted to do was articulate that framework and also show that the agency, again, one or both agencies, were bringing cases. And, again, in the work we did in OPP, and with the bureaus, we identified over the last 25 or so years, 100 or so cases that fell into potential competition or emerging competition area. One goal was to just make that clear to the public. And people who are interested in this topic, including people on the Hill, including people in the, policy groups. That was largely backward looking, although, I think we wanted to explain how the commission thought about the application of Section 2, the acquisitions of nascent or potential competitors, Now, you can imagine at least some of that would run up against the enforcement efforts, right, that were underway at the time. And so that created some difficulty in getting that document completed and out. And again, I think with the filing of case against Facebook in particular, it's going to be hard to publish for the agency to publish, sort of a framework for evaluating such transactions. Now, the second part of your question is, in addition to thinking about, what had the agency done and what was its framework over the last 25 or so years, we wanted to see, we wanted some, I'll call it empirical data or evaluation of acquisitions by, large companies, in this case, again, the five of the largest platform companies, but five of the largest market cap companies, of smaller companies. Now, we were not alleging we're not saying this was a study of the acquisition of nascent competitors. This was a study of the acquisition of smaller firms, to see if they had effects either singularly or in the aggregate that could be perceived as the acquisition of nascent competitors and the acquisitions that led to loss of future competition. But it was also intended to take a look at the efficiency efficiencies that came out of those acquisitions. And again, to see if, in a sense, apply sort of, again, a balancing approach to evaluating such conduct. Now, you know, I think there's a lot of reporting on the acquisitions by those five companies, but not a lot of in-depth analysis of either what they were acquiring, what was acquired, and how those assets, you know, fit into the acquirer's, you know, sort of business model or products, both their current products and potential future products. And so that was the intent. It, I assume, still the intent of the study. You know, I think the team that's working on that, led by Katie Ambrosi and Leon Wagman, have done a tremendous amount of work in identifying, you know, what types of acquisitions these were, what they were intended to do, maybe not so much what their effects were, because that's a much different analysis, but whether these products or assets, you know, were integrated into the company's products or not. And I think it's probably the most important 6B study the agency's done in a long time, right? There's a lot of chatter about, you know, acquisitions by the large tech companies and whether they should be stopped or subject to a different standard. But there's very little reflection on the potential benefits associated with those acquisitions. And there's also very little information on those, on that. So what the team is doing is trying to work through that and have something to say. We also wanted to identify limitations in the HSR rules with respect to notification of small transactions. You know, the study was formulated to only require documents and information with respect to transactions that were not notified to the FTC and DOJ. And I think, you know, it's what the information we got has confirmed the few ideas that, you know, we've been kicking around in OPP about limitations in the HSR Act. For example, I'll give you one. I think there's only something Hart-Scott experts probably know and recognize, but there is different treatment in the jurisdictional tests between manufacturing and non-manufacturing companies. And that may have made sense in, you know, the mid-70s, when what I think we were concerned about at the, you know, with respect to mergers, you know, was sort of focused on manufacturing industries. Now, at least with respect to these tech companies and lots of the industries, we're focused a lot on the effects in service markets or other non-manufacturing markets. And even sometimes retail markets. So, you know, I think we saw a fair number of transactions that were above the Hart-Scott size of transaction threshold that were not filed because of, you know, this limited, this slightly different treatment with respect to manufacturing and non-manufacturing companies. So I think, you know, there are a number of things that will hopefully come out of this study that may lead to either legislative fixes or internal FTC rule fixes. But most importantly, I think a better understanding of why these acquisitions are undertaken, what their possible effects are, and I think potentially a greater recognition of the potential benefits of them, you know, but you know, it's a big study. They take time, but I hope it gets out, you know, in the next year or so. And I'll tell you, the other thing that's amazing that the team did you know, we have data from, you know, public or proprietary, but public sources on, you know, somewhere in the range of 35 to 37,000 acquisitions in what you might call the tech space. And, you know, Liad, who's an economist and a small team, is trying to find, you know, get some learning from that information. And that's, you know, that's, let's say, 35, 37,000 transactions occurring over the 2010 to 2019 period. It's not, obviously, it's not limited to the five companies. It's not limited to non-Hart-Scott reportable transactions. It's probably not limited to only U.S. acquisitions of U.S. companies. But it is a significant effort that I think will advance the understanding of these acquisitions. And I only wish we had started it earlier, because I think it's, you know, critically important as people consider legislative changes that may really undercut the dynamism of the tech space, you know, and focus, you know, focus solely on, you know, perceived harm that you know, the disruption, right? I mean, what's occurring is significant disruption of a number of industries, and you know, it's not infrequent that a competitor who's been disrupted out of a nice business complains about, you know, the disruption and the firms causing the disruption. And, you know, my sense is that's a significant strength of the dynamism of the U.S. economy. And you know, the Congress and the agencies and the courts ought to be very careful about adopting positions that or laws that that hinder that dynamism. I'm not saying change is not appropriate. And the documents I've talked about were an attempt to get in front of the curve. But, you know, there's a lot of policy proposals out there that actually don't reflect the reality of conduct, the effects of the conduct or the acquisitions by those companies. And I think the 6B study, you know, will be a real help to providing some real analysis of that.
Hey, thanks. Sticking with the HSR topic, last fall, the FTC, with DOJ concurrence, proposed amending existing rules implementing HSR to create a new de minimis exemption from the notification filing requirement for acquirers. The proposal would also change the definition of an acquiring party to include its associates under common management. So can you elaborate more on what the FTC tried to do here, and what do you believe will happen in the new administration?
So I think, you know, you mentioned two of the proposals, and then, of course, in conjunction with the proposed rules, the agency went out with an advance notice, which raised questions about seven additional topics that in some ways overlapped with the NPRM, in some ways went off in slightly broader directions. So what was the agency trying to accomplish? I think they're trying to accomplish two things. It's been 25 years since there was a major revision to the HSR rules, and that, you know, that revision was in the mid-90s, and it you know, set forward a number of, at the time, new exemptions that would eliminate filings for a handful of, a set of transactions that were not perceived as likely to be anti-competitive. It's also many of the rules and interpretations of the rules that the NPRM and the ANPRM focus on are basically as old as the rules themselves, so over 40 years old. and there's been significant change in the economy in those 40 years. And so I think, the agency, some of the commissioners, chair, the bureaus, OPP, thought it was time to try to bring some of those rules up to date. Most of the rule proposal changes, not all of them, most of them sort of relate in some ways to governance aspects of investors, not solely minority investors, but also the governance aspects associated with private equity firms, who manage multiple funds, but under the HSR rules, they're treated as separate entities. So in large part, it was an attempt to really rethink the rules in a systematic way and identify areas where, over time, there'd been sufficient change in the, not only the economy, but in the governance of companies, that a refresh was needed. Now, I've been a proponent of a de minimis exemption from reporting because I felt that it was a waste of resources for everybody to make a filing that didn't raise substantive concerns or to investigate firms for failing to comply with the HSR Act when, the transaction didn't raise competitive concerns and the failure to comply was arguably because of an unfamiliarity with some of the unique or specific characteristics of the rules. But of course, that lessening the burden on filings or filers or specific filers, is not sort of a sufficient thing for the agency to do. It ought to be rethinking, how it can, better size the HSR rules. One of the drivers of the proposal was to think about, the common ownership issue, right? We had done a hearing on the common ownership concern. The ANPRM includes a series of questions to better understand what institutional investors do with respect to their holdings or, the review of the empirical literature that OPP contracted for was an attempt to understand the effects of common ownership, what the empirical literature showed. And the aggregation rule within the NPRM, the redefinition of a person, was intended to reflect, I think, a concern that, we were, first, we were potentially not getting information on transactions that would have been useful to get, such as other ownership interests. It also is intended to reflect what, again, I think is the reality across the world, which is, I think it's largely only in the U.S. where you look sort of, fund by fund, as opposed to at sort of the higher level for private equity firms. And again, just reflect the greater reality of the governance of these firms. Now, that aggregation rule, that redefinition of person, can have some significant secondary effects with, in particular, how institutional investors' reporting obligations may change. And I think the ANPRM is an attempt to better understand the effect of the aggregation rule, a potential effect on those entities, and to think about whether some modification may be appropriate for institutional investors or others where their holdings may be and likely are, passive, at least passive with respect to issues of interest to the competition, competition agencies. But I did think it did strike me as indefensible that the application of the institutional investor exemption, you know, would allow a small number of firms to acquire 15% or less in competing companies without Hart-Scott review, particularly when, you know, that it wouldn't potentially be only one firm, but a small number of firms who in the aggregate built up, you know, significant positions in competing companies. Now, that's not to say they're anti-competitive. It's what I say is it just struck me as indefensible that, you know, we had a rule that at least in its application seemed to allow the this common ownership issue to arise without any, you know, pre-consummation review. Because of the importance of institutional investors to, you know, investments by ordinary citizens and groups like unions and other pension plans, it's important, I think, to get this right, not to put too much of a burden on them to file. But the agency, I think the agencies need to understand better what institutional investors are doing and what the effect of their holdings are, even if those holdings are passive. And, you know, one way to do that is through a, you know, post-filing or a post-acquisition system of review and investigations. But that wasn't really done either. So, you know, we thought the right way to tackle one of the topics of the hearings with common ownership was to think a little bit about, you know, how to better apply the Hart-Scott rules. So, you know, hopefully I've looked at the comments that were filed for both the NPRM and AMPRM. Hopefully the people who would be significantly affected by the aggregation rule, hopefully they proposed some alternatives that reflect the agency's concerns or address the agency's concerns, but also don't create, you know, the regulatory overhang that potentially would conflict with other agency jurisdiction or the potential real benefits of in a sense, the use of institutional investors to invest on behalf of Americans and retirees and pension holders and the like.
Great. Thank you so much for that. So we have just about 12 minutes left. I wanted to turn to one other hearing-related topic, and then I do see one question in the chat that I will ask you about. So just briefly to close out the hearings, which this was not under the auspices of the 21st Century Hearings, but the FTC conducted it under your tenure at OPP. And that relates to the issue of non-compete provisions in employment contracts. FTC held a hearing on or workshop on January 9th, 2020 to examine whether there was a sufficient legal basis and empirical economic support to promulgate a commission rule that would restrict the use of non-compete clauses in employer-employee employment contracts. Can you just elaborate very briefly on the goals for the hearing and what some challenges might be in terms of promulgating a rule under the unfair massive competition prong?
So I think the goal of the hearing, again, was to think hard about whether, you know, we could justify either a policy response or an enforcement response to the growth in the use of non-compete agreements, you know, in the economy. And I think, you know, the chairman was concerned about the potential effects of these non-competes, particularly where it was hard to see the justification for them. And I think, you know, a number of other commissioners also wondered about the justification for them and the potential for their effects to fall on you know, certain parts of, you know, low-wage workers or low-skill workers, who, you know, appeared to be struggling as a group in the economy. So there was a real interest in seeing whether, you know, notwithstanding the potential role of the Department of Labor or other agencies, a real interest in thinking about whether there was an FTC or antitrust response to the use of non-compete agreements. We John McAdams of the Bureau of Economics published sort of on his own a review of the empirical literature, and that was published in December of 2019 or January of 2020. That suggested to many people, I think, including us, that, you know, a broad-based ban on non-competes probably was not justified by the empirical literature. We were spending some time thinking about whether the empirical literature might support a more narrow rule, you know, focused on maybe low-wage workers, low-skill workers, you know, something other than, you know, a broad class of the economy. I think the biggest hurdle, besides, you know, the workload and you know, the effect of everybody sort of being working from home, was it was, again, clearly an area where there was disagreement among the commissioners, not so much on, you know, potential concerns about the effects of these non-competes, but on whether the commission really had rulemaking authority, or if it had rulemaking authority, you know, whether it could build a record for a rule that would sustain a challenge to it. So it again, OPP, at least up until I left, you know, was working on this area, but it was sort of backburnered because of, you know, likely differences among the commissioners and the significant importance of what I'll call equity and labor issues to the incoming administration. And it seemed both to the chairman and to me that on an area of significant interest to the incoming administration, you know, the commission should not issue a report or paper or recommendations that might have the effect of undercutting an important policy item for the incoming administration. So, I mean, it's a tough issue, but in the end, I think, however which way we might have come out or the commission might have come out, I think it was just something we didn't want to do in the last days of the administration when this issue seems of significant importance to the incoming administration.
That makes sense. So, Bilal, I did want to ask you two questions we received from the audience, and you could answer both one or none. I'll just restate the question from the audience. The first question is, you mentioned to one of my questions that the vertical merger guidelines were perhaps the only public accomplishment of the hearings. Were there any non-public accomplishments on which you could elaborate? The second question from the audience is, during your tenure, did OPP make any competition advocacy filings with state or federal entities that you felt had a significant impact?
So on the first question, I think, you know, I've talked about sort of the stuff that's non-public in the sense that we didn't release anything, right? We spent a lot of time on platform topic, on potential competition topic, on the common ownership topic. Whatever output there was or might be, all that work, I think, was helpful internal to the commission in thinking through those issues. So that's sort of the quasi non-public, that's the response to a non-public question, right? We couldn't get some things out, but the effort, I think, was helpful internally, and that, you know, may have some longer term effects. On the advocacy filings, you know, I think we suffered from a couple of things there. I am a big supporter of the competition advocacy mission because I believe, you know, there's too much government, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, you know, too much of what the government does, you know, restricts competition. And, you know, somebody and the agency and DOJ are as good as any to do it and better, you know, should be pushing for opening up markets, removing barriers to entry, whether it's rules or legislation, someone ought to be doing it. I think it is hard to identify an actual effect of this effort. And I think that ought to be a consideration of the program sort of going forward, right? How is it sufficient to plant the flag and say, you know, this is a good idea or a bad idea? You know, should we be measuring the outcome in a way that, you know, shows, you know, what effect the agency had? And the reason I say that is, you know, OPP devotes or has devoted a lot of resources to competition advocacy in different ways, maybe letters, maybe reports. And I do wonder, you know, if that's the best use of as many of the resources as are devoted to it. Now, during my time there, we did cut back on it in part because of, you know, we had these other projects. And I think in the last year of my time there, roughly the last year, you know, the COVID, you know, has affected what state legislatures are doing. And there were, I think, fewer opportunities to comment on things. So, you know, right now, I'd say a good chunk of the advocacy we did in the roughly 3 years I was director, you know, was focused on topics we'd already commented on to, you know, other legislatures. So I'm not sure any of them had I'm not sure there was a marginal benefit to most or all of them, with maybe one exception. Within OPP, a few people, Dan Gilman in particular, but others, and then outside of OPP, including a couple of people in the healthcare shop, did work with HHS on their health, you know, sort of IT agenda. And I think we did have some effect there, both through public advocacy and through, you know, agency to agency discussions on whether some of their rules were going to be anti-competitive and that they would, you know, basically allow for static or not allow for dynamic competition. And I think the telemedicine, telehealth work that we did was potentially helpful in supporting what HHS and others wanted to do in response to COVID. You know, Karen Goldman did a nice paper on occupational licensing and portability that I think advanced the literature in that area. And then, you know, the Trump administration had a lot of healthcare ideas, and both through public comments and agency to agency communications, I think we had you know, a positive impact on those. We filed comments with HHS on a number of things. So that those areas, most of those areas are, you know, I think it's worth thinking about what's the best use of the advocacy function of OPP and where to put those resources.
Great. Well, I see Nick is back on, so I think that means that we're running out of time. We did have one additional audience question on the privacy hearings that the FTC had. Bilal, I don't know if you want to take that question or whether we want to just conclude, and if you have any other thoughts as closing remarks for this session. So, Bilal, I'll turn it to you.
So, you know, I think on privacy, that was an area where OPP had a real interest, but less experience than in other areas. But I think there was also a difference in views And so what was the right path forward on privacy? You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, Liad Wagman, you know, has been working with us in OPP. Liad has done a lot of writing in the area of privacy and the application of economics to privacy. He's done both, I'll call it theoretical work, but also empirical work. You know, there are other folks in OPP, Dan Gilman, Ruth Yudakin, who have an interest in privacy. But it was an area where I think OPP was not in sync with BCP and particularly DPIP on the right forward-looking approach. And again, that was an area where, you know, I thought the commission, because it holds itself out as the privacy expert, could be more aggressive in advising on a, you know, a proper legislative, I'll call it, action with respect to privacy. But within the commission, well, you know, I don't think that was a view across the commission. And OPP was in the worst place to push for a more active role because we were largely out of step with where BCP was. Now, I think there is a majority, even at the time, there was a majority of the commission that was ready to act with respect to privacy because of the failure of Congress to either adopt or enact, you know, legislation that would clarify, you know, some of the rights associated with data and expectations of what companies should be doing. But it looks to me now that over the next 3-4 years, there's going to be a majority on the commission that is willing to use the FTC's rulemaking authority to, you know, to enact some kind of privacy rule that's within the scope of what the agency can do. I think that's probably warranted, putting aside what that rule looks like. I think a commission initiative is probably warranted, given the two things. I think both the inability of Congress to enact privacy legislation and Congress's looking for, you know, the FTC and maybe some other agencies to step up on their own. The benefit of the agency acting is, although I think OPP was out front on this amount of step, if the agency acts, there will be internally, you know, a better reflection of the economic strength or costs and benefits of privacy legislation or privacy rule than any other agency will provide. So, you know, more, you know, I think again, any report that we did or tried to do was not going to go far. But Liad and Dan has done some good work. Hopefully it will be published, you know, somewhere as a paper. But you know, we just weren't in a position to get agreement, you know, across the staff on anything.
That makes sense. And thank you to that audience question. So I think we're right out of time. So Bilal, I don't know if you have any closing remarks or anything else you wanted to say at this point.
Well, I have lots of things I want to say, but I think, you know, the one thing I'd say is I think the agency is an important agency within the federal government. It was regrettable that, you know, unlike the years I'd been there previously and most of my practicing career, there were a lot of differences among the commissioners that couldn't be resolved. And it led, you know, it leads to a weaker agency. And I think there are small number of people, maybe large, but at least a small number of people who would sort of like to kill the agency for different reasons. And, you know, I think the inability of you know, the commissioners to put aside some differences that strike me as relatively small is going to hurt the agency. And that's something that ought to be, you know, something that the management of the place ought to consider going forward. You know, if the place becomes a 3-2 commission on a regular basis, it just weakens the case for maintaining it. There's another there's another branch of the government that does antitrust enforcement. There's another branch that does some consumer protection stuff. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, a new privacy and data security agency. So, you know, in addition to getting more resources for the agency, which I support, there really needs to be a feeling among the staff, I think, I'm just speaking for myself, that the commissioners are all sort of rowing in the same direction and are protecting the agency from what I call the interests of people outside the agency. And those interests are not usually, you know, aligned with the FTC or the FTC's mission to protect consumers. So, it's not a place. For a long time, it wasn't a place that swung, you know, depending on who was the president. And you know, there's a real fear, I think, that it's going to become that way, and that, you know, then it'll just be seen as a superfluous agency.
Got it. Well, with that, thank you, Bilal, for being with us today. Thank you, Nick, and the Federalist Society for hosting us. Nick, I'll turn it back over to you for any closing remarks.
Thanks both Svetlana and Bilal for joining us today, and to our audience for calling in. Your good questions, good engagement on this event today. So just a reminder to the audience, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Also be checking our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls and Zoom events like this one. We have one coming up this Thursday. It's going to be on law and corporate social responsibility. It might be of interest to this group, and we're hosting a few speakers, including SEC Commissioner Elad Roisman. So tune in then. And this event will be posted as a podcast shortly. So check our website for that. Thank you all again for joining us this afternoon. We are adjourned.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.